Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast, Jamie and John together again. What's up, buddy?
Man, not a whole lot. Enjoying this this day of leisure.
It is.
Early day is. It gets busy later on, but you know what?
Yeah, we'll see what
Having
happens.
Having a good time.
A good day with no plans is a good day.
Yeah, I've been excited about this case.
Is that a fortune cookie?
Maybe, but I'm just going to pass over it. I've been researching this case, and it is intriguing. This is like quintessential True Crime Cast story.
And I'm going to tell you, like, most of our cases in the last few years have been listener recommendation. Like, we keep a list of things that come in. And this one, I watched a documentary and I thought, holy crap, this is such an interesting story to dive into. I have opinions. I'm sure John will have opinions. So maybe we say them out loud into a microphone.
That's typically what we do.
That is what we do.
I had an idea. You ever just have like shower ideas? Some of my best thinking is done in the shower.
All the time. I usually send them to you and never get a reply, but go on. What's yours?
I hate you. You're not wrong. I'm just,
yeah, you know, I have great ideas.
I want to start a thread on our Patreon labeled case suggestions. So usually we just get those in messages and have to compile our own list, but I want to start a list that says case suggestions. And then all of our Patreon members just put their suggestions on that list. It's made for us. It's efficient.
Excellent.
And it gets our Patreon members' voice.
I'm not even mad.
In one place.
Good idea. You need to execute that.
I'm really embarrassed that it took 8 years for me to have that idea. But here
we
are.
Good point. That's where we're at.
So, hey, if you have not joined Patreon, we're going to listen to any case recommendations, but our Patreon members will have one place to list all those in one place.
And it's give those move to the top of the list above non-patrons.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, but it is what it is.
I don't hate to say it. That's what they're there for.
If you would like to be considered a priority, no, hey, consider joining Patreon. It's as little as $3 a month. Not only do you get to leave case recommendations, but you get a brand new bonus episode only available to Patreon members at the beginning of every month. $3 a month, that is lower than the cost of even your most basic coffee at the Starbucks. So
it really is.
Give us a chance.
All right. So I want to give a shout out to somebody who left a 5-star review over on Apple Podcasts. This comes from 814, which may be an area code. If so, it's in Pennsylvania. So thanks, 814. It says, checked out this awesome podcast from Jamie and John after their first appearance on Talk is Jericho. I've listened to about 75% of their episodes and also tapped into their Patreon channel as well. Easily one of my favorite podcasts out there. So everybody in the 814, if that is an area code, we really appreciate that. We were on Talk is Jericho last week as well on Friday talking about DB Cooper. So go check that one out. Obviously, if those episodes get more viewership and more listeners, because he does video stuff, then we get asked back more often. So, go check that one out.
It was a lot of fun, and I've seen like some video content shared on social media. It was a really good time.
It was. That's my favorite crime story. I make no bones about that. So excited to talk to Chris about it, who had heard about it, but getting his perspective of kind of a fresh set of eyes was a lot of fun. But John, here we are. Byron Paul Griffey. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Byron was born on October 13th, 1935 in Nineveh, Colorado. So his parents were named Gay Vanderpool Griffey and Paul Lester Griffey. So I'm assuming Gay was the woman. I've heard Gay, as a male or female name. So.
Okay, yeah.
So Gay and Paul, and they already had 4 children, Otis, Theodore, Alma, and Leah. I guess Alma, I don't know, Alma and Leah. The family was reportedly extremely close, and everyone doted on their baby Byron. So when Byron graduated from the Dallas Institute of Mortuary Science in 1958, they were all by his side. So he had his degree, and he began working in a number of mortuaries around the state. And eventually, he moved to Fowler, Colorado, and opened the Griffey Family Funeral Home. He settled down in town, and that is where he and his wife had three little girls. So, Jamie, before I got married, I dated a girl whose family owned a cemetery in my hometown.
Yeah.
And it was one of those, like, it was probably started around the same time, like in the 50s at some point, and then passed down from the granddad to my girlfriend's dad. And then I kind of figured it would eventually be passed down to his kids, but it ended up not being. But it's a very family business. Like, everyone in your family is involved, from helping around the funeral home to being funeral directors. It's definitely a family affair.
So you spend a lot of time around funerals. So you're spending so much time around grieving people. Dead bodies are a part of your life. Like, it's such a different set of circumstances than 99.9% of the world.
Yeah. I mean, to me, looking in, like, it was a very strange part of their world. But once you got to know them, it was like, it was their job. Like, just like I go to work and I come home and then I live my life. That's how they did. I mean, they just happened to have a very sad job that some consider creepy. I'll never forget one time I was at their house hanging out, and they asked me to go over into the basement of the funeral home and grab something that one of them had left over there. And I went in, and there is just a gurney with someone on it, and they had a white sheet over them, but not over their face. And I went back, and I was like, guys, that was traumatizing. Why did you send me to do that? And they were like, oh, it's just Bill. I was like, why wasn't his face covered up? And they were like, it would dimple his nose. Like, it would push in on his. I was like, don't sit. I'm not a part of your family. This is not normal to me.
Yeah, it's really not. And again, it's to them, it's their way of life. And most of those individuals have compassion and work well with the families. Unfortunately, you have to go through that in the last year and a half or so. And I mean, they were so helpful. And God bless the people that do it. But man, it's just different. I mean, not bad. It's just very, very different. And in a town like Fowler, their family quickly became kind of pillars of the community. Byron was elected to the Fowler County School Board and served there for 13 years. And then we fast forward to kind of our story. Let's assume they're just kind of anchors of Fowler. Things are going great. They're little girls, Lindallin, Lynette, and Amy, doing well. And at some point down the line, Byron and his wife divorced, but Byron's still in town. He's still running the funeral home, and he's still well-known. He's known for helping local families through these difficult moments that we've been talking about. One of his daughters would say that he was the kind of guy who liked to take care of everybody. One of his daughters, Lynette, actually decided to move back to Fowler. She had her three kids and her new wife, Gina, with her. And he welcomed him into his home. He actually gave him his home, a farmhouse to live in, and he encouraged them to grow and be a part of the community like he had been for so many years. And they lived there very happily until 2011. They moved out of there after there were several break-in attempts, and they found a noose hanging in their barn. Now,
what the crap?
Yeah, absolutely. It's obviously Byron's a pillar of the community. Did somebody have an issue with the same-sex couple in his house? I don't know, honest to goodness, or if this is related to his death, but they started getting these issues. He started to think that somebody was out to get him, and I feel like that, you know, it's pretty good notion after all that happened.
Yeah, if your house is getting broke into and there's a noose hanging in your barn, I think that's a logical conclusion.
He also had a big collection of coins, old currency, and antiques, and what we find out is that if you take your money and you invest it in coins, that's a collector or a collection item or a collector's item, and it's not necessarily money. So you can have all this money and coins, but the tax situation is different because it's not like you have the cash in hand. So it's almost a way of legally laundering money. I guess that's what Byron saw it as. But he had a lot of coins, kept a lot of antiques, and it was estimated that he had coins worth millions of dollars.
And it's, you know, it's a sound investment because coins, silver, you know, they're not going to lose their value. There may be times if you're collecting these coins just because of the precious metal that their value may fluctuate.
Right.
But overall, if it's a valuable coin, it's only going to get more expensive.
Right.
So it is not a bad investment, and apparently a tax loophole.
Yeah, and you're a metal detecting guy. I know they've come out with several apps recently where you can scan a coin and see its value, which has got to be super helpful. But he would buy these things in boxes. When the new state quarters came out, he bought 4 boxes for each state, which is sounds expensive, but again, it was paying off. So he thought not only somebody out to get him, somebody's after his stuff. He kept these coins in a secret room filled with really secure safes, which, if you have valuables, I encourage you to keep them in a safe.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
You should do that.
So let's move backwards a little bit. In 1992, there were 2 newcomers to Florence. They were half-brothers, Charles Gibbler and Anthony Wright. And I can't say the word Gibbler without thinking of my buddy Kimmy from Full House.
Yep.
So these guys were ambitious entrepreneurs, and they quickly became well-known figures in town. And over 2 decades, they also opened up a funeral home. They also opened a restaurant and a guitar shop. So, you know, they had, for living people, they had a place to eat, get a guitar, and then when they died, they could go visit them as well. Not a bad investment plan.
Yeah, but Charles, very business-minded, really, you use the word ambitious entrepreneur. I think Charles definitely met that definition, and Anthony was his partner.
Yep. So by 2012, Charles became the town mayor and also an ordained bishop.
Big year for Charles, you know?
Yeah. So he held weekly services at a church that he founded in St. Jude, the Apostle Parish, and Wright served as a deacon. Executive producer of the ID documentary Rocky Mountain Mortician Murder said, quote, "They were icons and they were fixtures, and they really had in hand, or they had a hand in every aspect of life, from, you know, where they ate to where you went to listen to music to government to your death," end quote. Yeah, absolutely. This is all of these guys working together. Seems like they had a capital market there. Charles would often talk about his children and how proud that he was of them. One was in the military. One was a doctor. The brothers lived in an old Victorian home in town that they had bought and renovated, and many people noted that Charles was the brains and the charisma of the operation, while Anthony was the one that made things happen.
I will say that's the documentary that I watched to find out about all this, and you get insight, and I'm not going to spoil anything yet, but you get to see all the living people from this story talking about their perspective and kind of reacting to the twists and turns, which are yet to come. On October 12, 2012, Lynette and Gina were waiting for Lynette's dad to come over for a birthday dinner. When Byron didn't show up, they got worried, so they went to the farm to look for him. Had there been an accident? Was he okay? Gina entered the house first, and she made a gruesome discovery. Byron was laying in an empty bedroom in their old house, on the floor, dead from a single gunshot wound to the back of his head. They called the police immediately, who noted a few strange things about the scene. First of all, there was very little blood. No matter what kind of weapon is used, a firearm that close to your head is going to have a mess.
I mean, I remember taking my kids on vacation one time, and my daughter got hit in the forehead, and it busted her forehead open, and the amount of blood was insane.
The head bleeds.
So I would imagine a gunshot wound to the head would have produced more blood than what they had seen.
Yeah.
So they found it odd.
Yeah, super odd. And of course, even if there's not immediate blood spatter, he had been laying there, and there would be draining blood and those types of things. His body also kind of looked staged. He was shot in the back of the head, but he was lying on his back, and he had his arms to his side as if he had been laid in a coffin. So his body was literally staged as if he was going to be placed in a coffin.
So it seems like right off the bat, he was not killed, obviously, in this position. So he might have been killed elsewhere and brought to this place.
There were no defensive wounds, no evidence of a struggle, no signs of forced entry. And the coroner noted that the blood spatter was nothing like what he had seen. Byron Griffey was one day away from his 77th birthday. Charles Gibler and Anthony Wright handled the arrangements for Byron's funeral, and nearly the entire town came out because, again, he is the guy. They came out for this service. He's a beloved member of the community. Charles delivered the message at his service.
Was it held at the church that was founded by Byron?
That's a great question. I don't know. I would think, you know, Byron still had the funeral home in his name. I also imagine it was probably too small of a venue for the entire town. So I don't know where they held it. I also find their relationship interesting at this point. They have the same business. And I don't know because it is a business of compassion, what's the dynamic there between being competitors and being supportive of each other? By all accounts, they were supportive of each other. They would call each other and be like, hey, I have a family who needs this. I don't have one. Can you bring it? Like, it sounded like they worked together to serve the community. But that seems odd to me, especially with how ambitious Charles was. So,
yeah. I mean, but I did see that in my small town. There were 3 funeral homes and they all knew each other. There was only 1 mortician in town. So even though there was someone being, you know, held in 1 funeral home, the mortician who owned the funeral home was talking about would have to, you know, go and lend his services there.
Right.
So the mortician was still making money whether they were there or not.
Prepares the body, correct. Right? That's their training. That's their role. And that's something people go to college for. I have a kid who's thinking about college, and of all the conversations we have, him dealing with dead bodies how does that come up? Usually it's a family thing, but yeah. How does that come up for the person in the family that starts that?
Somebody's got to start it. It's weird.
When we get back from the break, we'll talk about the investigation and all the surprises we found in Fowler County.
The death was immediately ruled a homicide, and of course there was a case opened by the Otero County Sheriff's Department and the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. And the first thing they learned from Gina and Lynette is that Byron had plans earlier that day to meet up with his fellow morticians, Anthony and Charles. Knowing that they were at the farm the day Byron died, Charles and Anthony went to the CBI the next morning to give interviews. In my mind, that's a good sign that they came in willingly, you know, to talk about their day and what they were up to.
Seems like they wanted to help.
According to the men, they went to the farm to take Byron out for his birthday lunch. They said that they arrived at the farm at 12:30 and the gate was locked when they got there. Byron allegedly never picked up his phone or came outside, so after a while, they left. They claimed that after they didn't see Byron, they drove around Fowler looking for Byron's new house. And finally, they gave up, they got lunch, and they drove an hour back to Florence. Authorities looked into their story, and there were 2 missed calls on Byron's phone. The first one from the men was at 12:30, and the second was at 12:50 p.m., the time the men claimed to have left. Since the calls checked out, the men weren't questioned any further at that time. In fact, interviews were leading authorities to 2 other suspects.
Yeah, the suspects are very interesting as we get into the early investigation. The first was Gina's son, Byron's step-grandson, Corey Higgs. Corey had a very troubled past, and he was placed in his step-grandfather's care when he was 16 years old.
So that's Byron.
That is Byron. Yes, right. That's interesting. Yeah. So his wife married Gina. Lynette married Gina, and this is Gina's son. So that's the relation there.
Lynette is his daughter.
Yes.
That Gina married, and this is Gina's son. Okay.
Daughter-in-law's son from a previous marriage.
Talk to me like you're talking to a 5-year-old.
We're going
to
take a break and draw a chart. Just kidding about that part. So he lived with Byron, and at some point he accused Byron of sexually abusing him. He claims that Byron would pay him for sexual favors, but Corey's mom and Lynette didn't believe Corey when he made these claims. His mom, Gina, would say that Corey is a master manipulator. And they say this is the kind of accusation that he would make up just to hurt the family for not taking him out of foster care when he was younger. So, you know, if, again, the dynamics of this family are already messing. A kid, Corey, is claiming he's being sexually abused and they immediately don't believe him. Just makes my stomach feel uneasy.
Well, and what was the story with him being in foster care at one time? So that it seems like we could probably spend an entire case going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I think Corey's story is one that we don't get the full insight into, but obviously plays a factor in this one. So they investigated into Byron. He was actually arrested in 2012. He maintained his innocence, but he ultimately pled guilty to sexual assault on a minor. After that, Byron was no longer allowed to see his grandkids, which was devastating to him, one of the most family-oriented individuals you'll know. His daughter said he went from loving and warm, and then after this case, he was scared and depressed. He was allegedly afraid that Corey would sue him and try to get all of his valuables. Now that he had won the legal case, he was afraid he would be pursued civilly and that Corey would continue to try to ruin him. Because while he pled guilty, he maintained his innocence. In fact, detectives theorized that Corey had the personal and financial motive to, again, attack Byron legally, but also to attack him physically. Plus, his alibi couldn't be confirmed, so nobody really knew where he was.
He said to the police that he was just home by himself, so no one could verify that.
Worst alibi ever. I guess with cell phones now, that's more readily checkable, identifiable, but
you can always leave your cell phone at home and commit a crime.
Yeah, this is John's how-to commit murder.
Not that I've ever thought about doing so.
They also considered the fact that Byron was afraid of Corey. And if he saw Corey coming to the house, he would have called the police. So the fact there was no forced entry, he didn't call for help. You know, Corey's a suspect, but it's not certain that he did it. He wouldn't have opened the door for Corey. So unless Corey snuck in without him seeing, which would have been hard to do, the gate was closed. You know, it's hard to figure out exactly where Corey was at this time. They gave Corey a polygraph, which I think is crap. He's seems to have psychopathic tendencies based on what his family says about him. Passed the test.
I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate, or he was legitimately sexually abused by Byron.
I'm not saying that didn't happen. There's other evidence to support that happened. We may talk about later. There are others that allege to have a similar relationship with Byron, but
I can never see myself pleading guilty for something I did not do. But that's just me.
We've been doing this for 8 years. A ton of people have done it.
I know. Okay. I just can't fathom a world that I would plead guilty to something I didn't do.
And wouldn't that make Corey even more likely to be a suspect in his murder if he was abused?
I think so. Yeah.
So anyway, he passed the polygraph and they officially moved on from him as a suspect.
Well, apparently this agency loved some polygraph tests because they did a test on someone who did not pass. And that man was named Tommy Tomlin, which is the most Jellicoe, Tennessee name
could
hear, but this is again in Colorado.
I bet his first name was Thomas and his middle name was Tommy.
I bet.
Thomas, right. Tommy Tomlin.
Tommy was a handyman in Fowler who did a lot of work for Byron. And the police questioned more people and they found out that Byron had a reputation around town. He was known as the guy that had money and would pay men in town for odd jobs. And by odd jobs, it means sexual favors.
Yep.
Maybe odd jobs too, but sexual favors definitely.
Right, which supports Corey's claim.
Tommy was one of the men who Byron paid, but eventually the two of them developed a relationship. So the two would allegedly eat turkey pot pies, and watch pornography together at Byron's home.
I just need you to soak in that sentence
that
a little bit.
That is a tradition that is, yeah. I mean, if that's your thing, man.
Turkey pot pies and porn.
I personally like chicken pot pies, but I'm never going to have this tradition.
Do you find it odd the turkey pot pie people haven't marketed to the porn watching crowd?
I'm having too much fun with that. Market, I guess. So even though they were in a relationship, Byron allegedly continued to give Tommy money. Even though Tommy failed his polygraph, when he was questioned, a few things about this theory just didn't add up. So first of all, they thought if Tommy did it, why would he go all the way out to the farmhouse to commit the crime and not do it in Byron's home when the two had always spent time together there? They also guessed that if it was a crime of passion, it wouldn't have been so clean. Plus, the family said the motive made no sense because Tommy would have made more money from Byron if he were alive than if he were dead. But, I mean, some questions that I have is if it was Tommy and the motive wasn't money, perhaps they were seeing each other and Tommy was jealous about, did Byron have a relationship with somebody else? But they go back to, well, the scene. The scene didn't indicate that this was a crime of passion. But again, I don't know that the scene we see is where the crime took place.
Yep.
So I just have more questions.
So many questions. Yeah. And it looked like the crime looked like a business decision. So let's go back to some businessmen, if you will, Charles and Anthony. And even though they came straight into the GBI, there were some inconsistencies in their stories. As it turns out, they were having some financial difficulties. Yes, they owned a ton of businesses, but they all weren't doing great. And one thing that entrepreneurs do often is take money they have and invest it in new businesses. So I think they had stretched themselves too thin and were not doing great. And we later find out that Byron had asked Charles and Anthony to store some of his coins. Remember, he has millions of dollars in coins. He has them in safes around the farmhouse. He moves out of the farmhouse into a different house. He needed somewhere to put some coins, and he called Charles and Anthony, had been business partners, had grown to be friends, and they had been keeping some of these. As it turns out, Gina tells cops that Byron had been trying to get in touch with them several times because he wanted to go and document all the coins they had so that there was a record of, you have 48 boxes of quarters, 12 boxes of antique coins, and so forth, so that when it was time to pick them up, they could settle up appropriately. But allegedly, Charles and Anthony were always busy, too busy to meet with Byron about what was happening. Lynette and Gina also pointed out it was strange that Anthony and Charles wanted to meet at the farm since Byron didn't live there. They had no reason to have Byron drive up to the farm and meet him there. They could have easily met at a restaurant or met at his house. We all have cell phones now, right? Like, it's not the only place they can find him. And then everything starts to unravel.
In 2013, police found out that Charles and Anthony were not half brothers. They were a couple.
Boom.
So when they moved to town, they hid their real identities in an effort to simply fit in. But the real nature of their relationship came to light when Anthony fell for a local woman named Laura Anderson. She was a probation officer who was the mother of one of their employees. This is starting to turn into a crazy love triangle.
I don't think I
legitimately need a diagram.
Yeah, I don't think a triangle is the shape. I think it's some kind of...
It's a polygon?
It's a hexagon of some kind.
Anthony decided to leave Charles for this woman. So according to Anthony, while the two were in a relationship, they hadn't been intimate or romantic in years. They were essentially roommates and business partners, and Anthony was ready to move on. Florence resident Georgia Inslow said, quote, "When I learned Charles and Anthony weren't brothers, wow, it was a sense of betrayal. I think a lot of people in Florence felt that way. It was almost like the whole town got duped." End quote. Yeah, these people are kind of, like you said, a pillar of this community. And basically they realized that the foundation of who they thought these guys were is not at all true. So it turns out lying was nothing new for Charles. He always told wild stories that didn't always seem real. And it turns out he never had a wife or children. He pretended to take calls in front of people and, you know, from his family that just simply never existed. Those were all just made up conversations in front of people to build this story. And when he was dumped, Charles was stressed, but trying to find ways to be excited to be single again. Between Byron's murder investigation and his breakup with Anthony, Charles was under an intense amount of stress. He even told a member of the Griffey family that he expected to be arrested in connection with Byron's murder. Why? Why would you expect to be arrested for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think he knows that police are at least interested to talk to them a little bit more. And as the more they talk, the more inconsistencies they found. One big thing for authorities was the men claimed that they drove out to Byron's farm in their black Mercedes. And they were adamant. Yeah, we drove our black car. That's what we drive. But they found surveillance footage of them in town, and they were driving a two-seater white van. The receipt from the restaurant was also not helpful. They said they drove around for an hour and then got lunch, which if they left at 1:50, so they're getting lunch a little earlier, around just before 2 o'clock. But the lunch buffet said you pay before you eat, and that showed that they had went to eat at 2:30. And that restaurant was only about a half hour from the farmhouse. So that means that somewhere in here, there was an hour that was completely unaccounted for. If you follow their story based on when they went to a restaurant, they should have gotten there at 1:30, not 2:30.
Let me see if I can track this in my head. So they said they got to his farm 12:30. They called him, waited 20 minutes. He didn't answer. So they left. They drove around for an hour trying to look for him.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're at
just after 1:30.
1:30. And then they drove 30 more minutes to this restaurant. So they should have got at the restaurant at 2 o'clock.
At the latest.
Right. And this says they were there paid before they ate at 2:30.
Yeah.
So there's 30 to 45 minutes that are not accounted for.
Yeah. I mean, driving around for an hour, if I tell you I drive around our town for an hour, you're not going to know where I end up. So I think police got a more detailed account and said they were actually closer to the restaurant. So it was closer to, they should have been there at 1:30. Authorities theorized that this hour was used to stage the crime scene and to clean up and to get rid of any evidence that they had been at the farmhouse and that they are the ones that killed Byron. So that was the ongoing theory for why Charles and Anthony were still being considered.
Anthony told authorities that he simply forgot about which car they took that day. Investigators asked how they planned to take Byron to lunch if they were only in a van that was a two-seater. And Anthony said it didn't matter because they always ended up taking Byron's car anyway and that it had enough seats for everybody. So I guess these guys had a lot of cars. I remember researching this case and they had basically a bowl that they would keep keys in.
Mm-hmm.
And as they left the house, they would take a set of keys and whatever that set was, they drove that day.
Yep.
That's kind of cool. I mean,
it could be. I can't imagine that world. I mean, right now it's trying to coordinate an entire family of people going places. You're always trying to swap cars and figure out who needs to go where. So I guess they lived a little bit more on the edge than I do.
So detectives were convinced that Charles and Anthony were motivated by financial greed as the guardians of Byron's coins, his silver and gold for months. They theorized the couple had spent Byron's money and then killed him to cover it all up. Lynette told authorities that when she asked to have her father's property returned to her, Charles agreed, but it was not all there. Out of the 400 boxes of state quarters that Byron had, they only received 60 of those boxes back. So 340 boxes unaccounted for, right? I'm trying to do math on the fly.
Yeah.
And you know I'm from Tennessee.
That's like 91% of them are gone.
Lynette said that there was a safe missing that had approximately $50,000 in it. Gina said that Charles and Anthony initially took Byron's valuables for safekeeping because they needed a large van, and it was so loaded down, it drove low to the ground when they left. So they filled this thing up with so much that this van was like, you know, if you see a pickup truck with a lot of load in it, you can see that it's squatted.
Yep.
And when they picked up this stuff initially, that's what their van looked like. But when they went to retrieve it, Gina said they brought a pickup truck, and what they were given didn't even fill half of the truck bed. So obviously there's a lot of stuff that's missing. Charles and Anthony claimed that they had half of Byron's collection, but Gina and Lynette said they never saw the gold or the entire gold collection.
So they didn't know that they had half because they didn't know what the total was. And remember, Byron wanted to do an inventory, but they kept dodging him. So who knows what they had? Nobody did. That was kind of the point of them dodging him, it seems like.
And I mean, sadly, it seems like Byron had so much that he couldn't even account for all the things that he had given them for safekeeping.
Right. And if you look at the value of these 400 boxes, getting 60 back is nothing.
Yeah.
It's nothing. So if they indeed did what Gina and Lynette claim, they took so much money from this family.
But both can be true. I mean, they could have stolen from Byron, but that doesn't mean they killed him.
Yep.
I mean, okay, let's keep going.
Okay. So officials were in the middle of writing up arrest warrants to arrest Charles and Anthony for the murder of Byron Griffey. But things changed wildly on January 25th of 2013. That morning, Charles Gibler was found dead in his home. An autopsy showed that he had died of natural causes, but people in town still had questions. I mean, if you live in this town and all of these things have happened and you have found out that these guys were not brothers, which they had claimed to be for years and years in this town, I don't think you take anything as truth. Even though he was being looked at as a murderer, potentially, the 52-year-old was still given a mayor's funeral. People filled up the Florence County High School auditorium for his services. Anthony did not attend the funeral, and he openly blamed the police for Charles's death. According to him, the police pestered, this was Anthony's word, Charles, so much about this crime that he felt so much stress that that's what caused him to die of natural causes.
In August of 2013, Anthony was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder in connection with Byron Griffey's murder. So he would plead not guilty, and ultimately the case would go to trial. But after 2 days of deliberation, the jury came back, and they were unable to reach a verdict. So this was a hung jury, and it ended in a mistrial. So facing a retrial and the real possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison, Anthony decided to take a plea deal in 2017. Entering the plea agreement would mean that Anthony admitted that he aided and abetted or rendered assistance to Charles, who he knew had committed the crime of first-degree murder. So the 46-year-old was sentenced to 10 years of probation, a $25,000 fine, and 250 hours of community service. He still claims that he is innocent of this crime, but he was advised by his attorney that going back after a mistrial, quote, very rarely goes in the defendant's favor, end quote. So he said that he didn't see a way out and just had to take the plea as a lesser of two evils, even though he says he did not commit this crime.
So this is the second person taking a plea deal that says that they did not do it.
The first being Byron in the sexual abuse case of his step-grandson, Corey.
Byron's family was not happy with his sentence, as you can imagine. No jail time for somebody involved in somebody's murder seems absurd. One of Byron's daughters said, I don't understand how someone charged with first-degree murder and arrested on a $1 million bond is released on an ankle monitor and is now given a plea only to accessory to murder. How does that happen? It just doesn't make sense. And now no jail time and only probation? The daughter actually said to the judge, Charles and Anthony were my dad's friends, maybe some of his best friends. He supported them and appointed Charles trustee to take care of his estate at the time of his death. How ironic that they were the ones trusted to take care of his final affairs, and they ended up murdering him. 4.5 years' time has passed, and it's not getting any easier. Nothing can ever compensate us for the loss of our dad and grandpa, and it's hard to see that justice is truly being served. On the other hand, Anthony's brother Ken spoke up, saying, "The frustrating thing for me is all the time here in court, I've never heard any physical evidence that linked him to the crime. He has sold everything he had and has nothing left. He paid $250,000 just for the first round of attorneys, and all five of his successful businesses are gone."
And you could argue that that money was Byron's if he sold Byron stuff to get that money.
Or to pay for those businesses. No, you're absolutely right. And if you think that he did it, then even if Charles had that money, we don't know exactly how Charles's estate was split up, but you got to think Anthony was involved in that as the closest person in relation to him. As of today, Anthony and Laura, who are now married, live in Colorado, where they try to lead a quiet life. Both of them did speak for this documentary. Anthony cannot leave Colorado until his sentence ends, and this is the probation, in 2027. So next year, his sentence is over, and he allegedly either planned or committed this murder, pled guilty to helping somebody else do it, and got no time in prison. First of all, I hate this sentence. It feels like a way for the state to check a box. There was no justice done if Anthony did this. Let me say that before I go back and say whether I think they did it. But yeah, I hate this sentence.
Yeah, I guess to be fair, I don't like it either, because as I'm researching this case, I don't know that I see physical evidence either. So I feel like what you said is true, that this seems like the state just checking a box off. And I, you know, I guess I'm led to believe I really don't know what happened. I don't have a great narrative. I mean, usually when someone pleads guilty, they, part of that sentencing or part of that is you have to lay out explicitly all the details. Did we have that? I mean, did Anthony share like a specific timeline of when, how, where, and by what means? So
certainly not that I'm aware of. And
we just don't have that. And I think it should be something accessible to the public. So if we end up finding that, our research did not turn it up. If we find it, we will make an update to this on a future Patreon episode.
Absolutely. And so your opinion is we had no information, not enough information to move forward.
But I mean, that's to my limited understanding. Maybe there were more if you were in court, but they obviously accepted this plea deal and they gave him the sentence. I personally would love to see a forensic accountant get involved to see, does Anthony have money that is, you know, that comes from a source unknown? Did he sell all of Byron's stuff to fund his attorney, to fund his new life? And I think a forensic accountant would be able to really take a deep dive and answer some of those questions for me.
Yeah, I think their story was really inconsistent, so I tend to think of them as the lead suspects, but I see nothing that would show that they actually had something to do with it. No physical evidence tying them to it. I'm all about considering circumstantial evidence if needed, but I just can't wrap my mind around this case being closed in any way. I think
there has to be a civil trial coming down, right? I mean, if he pled guilty to everything, or being an accomplice, if you will, there has to still be civil matters that could be tried in court as far as the coin collection and all the antiques. Where did it all go?
See, I think that they should do that, if nothing else, to be able to subpoena people and to get that information. I think that's a big benefit for them. But as far as we know, that isn't happening yet. I encourage people to go watch this documentary. I think it could be helpful to see some of the players and to hear directly from them. But
I have one more question real quick. Because he pled guilty to basically being an accomplice and his first trial of first degree murder ended in a mistrial, if we do get more information, can he then legally be charged with first degree murder?
I would imagine part of the, I haven't seen the paperwork, but my understanding is that the plea deal made it to where if he pleads guilty to this, he cannot be further charged in relation to this crime criminally for anything. Now, civilly, obviously that's on the table, but criminally, I think he's off the hook.
Man, we need like victims need better attorneys to say, if we find more information, it definitely can be thrown at you. So
yeah, I completely agree. And I would love to know the actual language of that plea agreement to see if that's the case. Cause I would love to see the truth come out and actual justice served. I don't think we got that for anybody, even for Anthony at this point. I don't think that it was proven he did anything. So how do we know that he got the right sentence and his life has been ruined because of this? And if you prove he did it, great. If not, that shouldn't have happened.
Absolutely. Jamie, this was a good one. Thank you, man, for watching that documentary and recommending this case. Guys, please don't forget, go sign up for Patreon here in just another week or two. We're going to have a brand new episode for our February edition.
We really appreciate you all and can't wait till the next episode.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.